Aloha, I'm Anne Kaela Kelly, and welcome to The Native Truth, the podcast where all we talk about is the decolonized, First Peoples, First Nations, spiritual, cultural, physical, material, historical, and political reality. So, if you care about Native peoples, if you care about Indigenous cultures and shared histories of resistance, if you care about justice and Mother Earth, you're in the right place. This week, my guest is my first non-Native guest, attorney Lanny Senkin. It's important to acknowledge that the Native experience includes the non-Natives in our lives who stand in solidarity with us. Lanny is one of those people, and he has a long history of being a lawyer who isn't afraid to rumble. He sued the U.S. Navy on behalf of whales and other sea life that suffer and die as a result of the Navy's use of sonar, and he was part of the Christic Institute's legal team in the 80s that exposed the Iran-Contra scandal. And to remind you young ones, Lanny Guise outed the Reagan administration's illegal sales of military weapons to Iran in order to fund covert operations in Nicaragua through the Contras. For many years now, Lanny has been a dedicated defender of the rights of Native peoples. Lanny will talk story about the similarities and differences between protests at Standing Rock and Hawaiian resistance to building the 30-meter telescope on Mauna Kea. Then, another first for the Native Truth, in a segment called Kupuna Talk Story, Heli Malulani Kelly, Maima Koehine, will be sharing one of what I hope to be many stories about her small kid time growing up in South Kona. She was born in the Ahupua'a of Kealia, which is where her mother was born. Her father was born in Na'alehu, but he grew up in Ho'okena and was a hunter and a fisherman. Even after he moved his ohana up Mauka to Ke'e, my kukuman still kept his canoe at Ho'okena Beach. And Lamakumi Kahala Roy brings us a very special Ho'ailona report, inspired by a sighting earlier this week of an eel. But first, a few Native news headlines. As fires in the Bolivian part of the Amazon burn, there is growing criticism of the country's first Indigenous president, Evo Morales, who has refused to declare a national disaster. That designation would allow international aid to help fight fires that have already burned an area the size of New Hampshire and Vermont combined. Like other fires burning through the Amazon, it is believed Bolivia's fires were intentionally set to clear forested areas for cattle grazing and the cultivation of soy, 80% of which is turned into cattle feed. The fires coincide with Bolivia's increased beef exports to China and Europe. As the world's most biodiverse ecosystems are burning and indigenous peoples' territories are threatened and or decimated by the fires, it's feared that so far more than 2 million of the region's wild animals have perished. The International Indigenous Peoples Forum on Climate Change released a press statement outlining their commitment to climate action, which represents the relationship between indigenous peoples and their lands. The three commitments are: 1, lead the implementation of holistic plans to protect biocultural diversity, ensuring the inclusion of our most marginalized. 2, develop actions to secure Indigenous peoples' rights to lands, territories and resources, self-determination, and free, prior and informed consent, or FPIC. And 3, access the development of renewable energies in accordance with our self-determination and FPIC. The statement further reiterates the critical role of Indigenous knowledge systems and the direct link between protecting Indigenous territories and how traditional agriculture and land use results in the increased amount of carbon captured. Carbon dioxide is the main cause of global warming. And in Australia, reparation of ancestral remains has a new tool. The Return, Reconcile, Renew website was launched, aimed at helping to, quote, bring old people home, unquote. The site offers a guide to how to research museum archives and so-called collections that include the human remains of Aboriginals whose bodies and bones were either stolen from morgues or their gravesites. European, American, and other non-Indigenous societies have a long history of studying and, at times, displaying the remains of Native elders. During the 19th century, Aboriginal people's bones were especially prized. Despite a decades-long repatriation movement, many museums are still unwilling to part with what they regard as their property. Up next, a conversation with Lanny Senkin. Aloha, Lanny, and welcome to The Native Truth. I'm so happy that you could be on my show today. It's just great to have you as a guest, and also I'm excited to be able to introduce you to an audience that perhaps doesn't know about your work. So I'd really like to just start with back in the day when it started for you. You said earlier that you had been doing a particular kind of practice since 1976.
1976 was the beginning of my legal practice. And at that time, I was doing licensing hearings for nuclear power plants, trying to stop them from getting licenses.
Where was that? Was that in California?
It was in Texas.
And then is that where you started practicing law first, was in Texas?
Actually, because it was an administrative hearing, I could represent our group without being a lawyer. So I started practicing law before I became a lawyer. And one of the reasons I went back to law school was to learn how to do these hearings before they caught up with me. So my legal career actually began as just a citizen representative and then went on to become a lawyer.
Well, where did you end up studying law?
The University of Texas. In Austin.
Well, I know that in the 80s, you were instrumental in what's referred to as the Iran-Contra, what do we call it? The Iran-Contra deception?
Scandal.
Many things. Yes. There's a whole generation, there are a couple of generations of people now, especially in Hawaii, I would say, who aren't aware of what the Iran-Contra scandal was. And so can you speak to that for a minute and just educate people? Because I know you became involved as a lawyer through the Christic Institute, and it was, I'm old enough to have been around then, and I saw it in the news, and it was a really formative moment for resistance on many levels, but the legal story was really important and just the overall story. So can you tell people a little bit about what that the Iran-Contra affair was about?
Yeah, I'll try and do it in a nutshell here. That basically what happened is that there was a group down in Nicaragua called the Contras, who were fighting to overthrow the Sandinista government. And the U.S. Congress voted not to fund them. And so Ronald Reagan and his cohort of folks looked for alternative ways to fund them that wouldn't be through the Congress appropriations. And they set up this program where they went to sell Iran weapons in violation of the laws governing the sale of weapons. And they used the proceeds to fund the Contras down in Nicaragua to fight the Sandinista government. And all of this was illegal in a number of ways. I mean, they were violating all kinds of statutes. And we sued them. And what we went after was the private covert operation that was part of the Iran-Contra scandal. So Richard Secord, Albert Hakim, General John Singlob, they had formed a sort of private enterprise that was doing the dirty work outside of the purview of the government. They were working outside of Oliver North's door. He knew what they were doing.
He was funneling money to them?
He was helping funnel money to them, and they were also earning money off the cocaine they were smuggling. And we sued them as a racketeering enterprise under the RICO law, accusing them of drug smuggling, gun running, assassinations, and a variety of other crimes. And that was an incredible look within the national security apparatus of the United States, what was really going on.
Am I conflating stories when I ask you this? Didn't the cocaine they were bringing in, what was the effect that was having in the United States?
Well, actually, there were a number of pipelines that were open, and one of them led directly into the minority communities, particularly the African-American communities, and the whole crack cocaine thing grew out of the pipeline that had been set up to do this work. And you had another pipeline through Manuel Noriega, the president of Panama. He actually had letters from the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, complimenting him on helping them to bust cocaine smugglers. But what he was actually doing was turning his competitors over to the DEA so that he could become the sole provider of services to bring in the cocaine. And then when he was no longer useful, we invaded Panama and overthrew him and put him in prison.
I think when the United States invaded Iraq, it reminded me of what happened to Noriega.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah. Saddam Hussein was a similar kind of story.
You know, looking back on it now, historically, for the United States, what do you think the fallout was after the Iran-Contra affair?
Well, I think that there's a long history of these kinds of things happening and no one ever really being held accountable. One of the lessons I walked away from the Iran-Contra thing with was that if you make the scandal big enough, you can get away with it, because the leadership of the country doesn't really trust the people to know what the truth is. And they want to do things that the people would never approve of. So they have this whole side government doing things that people don't know anything about and would never approve of if they did. And Iran-Contra only reinforced that.
As I remember that case and all of these issues coming into the news and into the public and into the mainstream, I'll also say this. I don't know if there's been anything like it since that was that formative in terms of outing this national security apparatus, the way they use drugs, the way they illegally were funding a war,
right. Basically. Right.
I don't think nobody'd seen anything like that before. And I'm trying to imagine, like, have we seen anything quite like that since?
Certainly not on that scale or as visible. You know, we're still busy overthrowing governments around the world that don't toe the line that the United States Empire wants towed. So there are people probably going through Iran-Contra type events that we don't hear anything about.
You know, it's interesting. It's harder to get those kind of stories into the media, even though there's so much more media. There seems to be more outlets now because of the internet, but it doesn't mean that these stories are being told or that they're even being reported on. It's actually harder. No, I can say this as a journalist. It's actually harder to get published now than it was before.
Well, I think that's a very important observation. We have lost much of the edge of investigative journalism. One of the keys for us in our work on the Iran-Contra case was journalists who were out digging out what was going on in this whole Iran-Contra scheme. And they were cooperating with us, and we would share what we found with them, and they would share what they found with us. And often they were the ones finding the really important stories that broke a new piece wide open. And we've really lost the whole investigative journalism side of things, other than a few outlets that still remain.
I know, and when those outlets are funded by billionaires, then you got to wonder about that too. I know that you were part of a legal team representing some of the, or I don't know if it was one or all of the Lakota who were arrested with regard to Standing Rock and the resistance that was going on there. Can you talk a little bit about your work?
Sure.
With Standing Rock?
Yes. I was in Hawaii and I was called by Daniel Sheehan, who was the head of the Christic Institute that I worked under on Iran-Contra. And he called me in Hawaii and said that the Lakota People's Law Project, which was part of his work now, was providing legal defense to people charged with criminal activity during the encampment. And we were going in after everything was over. The camps had broken down. Everybody was gone. But all these people faced criminal charges. And we took two cases that we were going to make basically as the starlight cases to shine light on the whole operation. And one of them was Chase Iron Eyes, and the other was Holy Elk Lafferty. And we were out there for a year and a half doing the litigation and preparing the cases. Holy Elk decided to take a plea to get it out of her life because she had things she needed to do with children and elsewhere. And then in the Chase Iron Eyes case, the prosecutor saw us coming with we had some incredible research we had done on the treaties and the fact that this land was actually still their land, so they couldn't be charged with trespassing, which is what they were being charged with, because it was Lakota land. And we had some other major defenses we were going to put up. And the prosecuting attorney for the county in North Dakota decided to dismiss the case rather than have us get it into trial. So the charges were dismissed, and Chase Iron Eyes is a free man.
Wow, you guys were successful. You know, there was a lot of success, and there was a lot of, I guess I would say, failure with regard to Standing Rock, in that the pipeline has actually gone through there. But there were so many other things around that movement that all of us learned. And I think the legal part of it that you're talking about right now, I mean, that is one of the successes. Having had that experience at Standing Rock and now being involved with some of the legal issues around stopping the 30-meter telescope on Mauna Kea, what do you see as being similar to Standing Rock and different with regard to the Kukia'i Mauna?
Well, in similar, I think they are both seminal events that are sort of like the horns blowing, announcing that something important is coming. They are important in and of themselves, and I think they are the beginning of what is a major international movement, particularly by indigenous people, to reclaim their sovereignty and reclaim their practices and their culture and their faith, and try and lead the human family out of this dead-end canyon that these other death-worshipping cultures are leading us into with climate change and pollution and everything else. And that both Standing Rock and Mauna Kea are contributing to that awakening of the people to their own power and the need to exercise it in a responsible way to prevent disaster. So that's definitely one similarity I see. One difference I see is in Standing Rock, you at least had a coherent tribe on its own reservation and its own base then to which to operate. So the Lakota tribe was there long before the pipeline ever showed up, and they were able to respond from their land base in fighting the pipeline. Here with the 30-meter telescope, the Native Hawaiians don't have a land base. They basically are in what I refer to as a diaspora internal, that they don't have their own land base, they don't have their own institutions. So this had to be basically brought together by people who cared and joined in as things evolved and stayed informed and watched what was happening to the level where they could effectively affect it. And now I think there's no question that as far as the Mauna Kea case, it's a stalemate, it's a standoff. And there was a reporter who wrote a story today about how the polls have all changed, where now there's a major drop in support for the 30-meter telescope, and a major increase in the number of people saying that the Kia'i are doing the right thing. And a lot of the credit for that is given to how they have performed with Kapu Aloha, you know, keeping the peace, being nonviolent, and being very dedicated, standing, being firm. But this has really captured the attention of the world. It's an internationally recognized event. From my perspective, as an outsider to some extent, because I'm not Native Hawaiian, I also see it as sort of announcing that the kingdom's going to be restored, and that these are the early signs of that restoration that we're seeing now.
Well, that's interesting. I've actually heard that from a lot of people over these past months. I want to just move on to this, your actual legal involvement right now. Mm-hmm. I know that you're involved with the case brought by Mauna Kea and Aina Ho. It's a lawsuit that's trying to force the TMT Corporation to put up a bond. Is that what it is?
Right, yes. And we started looking at the 1977 plan for Mauna Kea. And as part of that plan, there was a provision that said any project on the mountain would have to post a bond equivalent to the cost of construction. And this was to ensure that if the project got started and it didn't have enough money to get finished, they wouldn't walk away and leave a disaster on these public lands. Or if they finished the project and then didn't have the money to decommission it when it was over, again, they would be leaving their telescope on public land, and the burden of paying for cleaning it up would be on the public. The idea of the bond is, they buy a bond that says, okay, if you run out of money and you can't do what you're supposed to do, the bond gets called upon and the public doesn't get called upon. So we filed suit starting with that particular 1977 plan as a basis, saying that the 30-meter Telescope International Observatory, TEO, should file a bond. And we went to court, and the judge agreed with the telescope people and the state that opposed our motion, that 1977 plan was no longer really active and couldn't be applied. However, the judge said, he took heart on our citing a recent Supreme Court case in Hawaii that talks about the public trust and the lands that were taken from the kingdom and given to the state of Hawaii by the United States, that those lands have a particular trust relationship, where the Board of Land and Natural Resources, which is the state agency that oversees these lands, has a fiduciary obligation as a trustee to protect the lands and be sure they aren't despoiled or abused or misused or whatever. And that this condition of abandoning a project or being unable to decommission it would be detrimental to the trust and therefore there's an obligation on the agency to buy a bond to see that the trust is not damaged by these by this project failing. So that's what the suit was all about. Where we are now is that the judge denied our motion based on the 77 plan, but instructed us that we should go back to the agency and ask them to require the posting of a bond and see if
go
we
back
can get
to,
them to do that.
To which agency?
To the Board of Land and Natural Resources.
Okay.
They have never dealt with that question. It was sort of left out of the whole process, the licensing and all of that.
So all these 13 observatories up there, none of them has put up a bond?
As far as we know, there was one attempt early on with a British one where they wanted them to post a bond. We don't know, we haven't found the records as to what actually happened with that one, but we have never found another instance in which they required a bond.
Which means they're already being negligent. They've already been negligent consistently.
We call it malfeasance.
Okay.
they have failed to perform their duty to protect the people. So we have filed an amended petition with the Board of Land and Natural Resources asking them to impose the bond, and they're kind of ducking the response. They suggested we go negotiate with TIO and see if we could talk TIO into posting a bond, which is
you
ridiculous.
Should do their job for them, is what
we
they're
should
saying.
Do their job for, yeah, right.
The state's going to have
and
you guys go and do it.
It's a job we know is going to fail. TIO's not interested in posting a bond. That's where we are. And so the orders dismissing our case were filed just a couple of days ago. So the clock is running. We're trying to decide whether to appeal the ruling on the 77 plan and another statute that we tried to get applied. Probably won't do that. But we are going to start our own clock on the Board of Land and Natural Resources reply and give them 30 days from the time the order was signed. And if they haven't done anything, go back to the judge and say, we really appreciate your suggestion. We went to them and they wouldn't do it. Can we litigate now whether they have an obligation under the public trust doctrine to post this bond and see what the judge has to say?
Well, wouldn't it be, I'm just going to kind of track the logic here. It seems to me that if the state were to require the TMT Corporation to actually put up, what, $1.4 billion, is it?
Well, it's probably $2 billion
by
now.
It's probably $2 billion by now, because that was that, you know, inflation.
Yeah.
But yeah, a billion ain't worth what it used to be, right? But if you ask them, if the state asks them to put up a bond, isn't that sort of, it seems to me that that would be them saying, at that point, they'd say, forget it. We really are going to take our project elsewhere, or attempt to.
Well, I'm hesitant to say that because I've thought numerous times that they would have reached that conclusion and be long gone by now. And every time I think that, you know, this is the one they're going to go, it's like impeaching Trump, you know, he does something on Monday and you think, well, surely they're going to impeach him. Tuesday, they don't talk about it anymore.
I know. It's worse now. It's you think at 8 in the morning, it looks like they might impeach him. And by 5 in the evening, it's maybe not.
Yes, exactly.
Well,
so that's what we're looking at here, is that kind of ducking it process.
Right. Well, this is really interesting, and I'm going to keep tracking the story. But Lanny, I just want to, you know, I have to wrap it up now, but I want to say to you, you know, mahalo nui for all that you do for Native peoples, but really on behalf of Kanaka Uiwi, I'm just one of many people who has deep, really enduring aloha and respect for you, brah, because you really have been there with us, and I just want you to know it's appreciated.
That means a lot to me. Thank you very much.
And now, our first Kupuna talk story. Aloha Makohene. Welcome to my podcast. I'm glad you could be on the Native Truth today.
Aloha to you too.
I want you to, if you can, share that story about how you learned how Hawaiians got messages from one end of the island to the other.
Sure. We had a Haole principal. He was the first Haole principal of Ho'okena School. And I was like in the seventh grade when he came. So he was my teacher for 2 years, seventh and eighth grade. And one day he had come in, he came to class and it looked like he was looking for some kind of response from us. Because he said that he had been talking to the old people in the area and old Hawaiians. And we found out that the messages like from the king of Kau would send a message to the king of Hona, and it would reach Kailua in 5 minutes from Kau to Kailua. And he didn't get any response from us. We never had anything Hawaiian talk to us. Nobody said anything that was Hawaiian school to us.
Okay.
And when I went home and asked my mom, I said, Ma, Mr. Eshwarman said that the Hawaiians used to send messages from Kau to Kailua, and it would take 5 minutes to get there. And I said, How can, Ma? And she didn't answer me. And my mom was the kolohe kind that always had some kind of a smart delicacy or whatever. And she was silent. And so I went back to do what I was doing. And about 5 minutes later, she said, the pahu, Malu, the pahu. And I guess she was taking it seriously. And she said it was by the pahu. She said, you send the man one pahu, with you eat the pahu here, and the sound would travel to another place, and then another pahu would pick it up, and then you send it on to another one, and that would pick it up and send it on. And she said, where there was no pahu, there were runners. The ali'i had runners.
Did you believe her?
Well, the way she was speaking, she was serious. Yeah, I believed her. It's hard for me to fathom that the message would get there in 5 minutes. Maybe it took a little more than 5 minutes, but it got there fast.
Right. That's interesting. Well, Mama, why do you you went to Ho'okena school, and I guess there was probably a lot of Hawaiians there when you were there, right?
Well, compared to today, yeah. But there was maybe half of the school was Hawaiian, and the other half were everybody else.
So why didn't you know any of this about your own Hawaiian stuff that had just taken place not that long ago in your area?
They just didn't teach Hawaiian things to us. And you have to remember now, I was there during the Second World War. And it was so pro-American that it wasn't even funny. It's just the way it was. It used to be we only raised up the American flag up in the morning and do the Pledge of Allegiance. But after Mr. Eshelman came, I think it was him, they started playing the bugle.
You mean that reverie call that they do with the bugle?
Yes, when we raise the flag in the morning. Yeah. The school started.
Well, remember when us kids, when we moved over to Honaunau for when I was in seventh grade and we went to school, that was the first time any of us had ever seen anything like that. It kind of shocked us to see that bugle thing in the morning with the Pledge of Allegiance. Very military, yeah.
No, I thought all schools did it. When my mom was in the third grade, she was about 8 years old.
At what school now?
Ho'okena school. And she said that the principal had all the kids in school carry out all books on Hawaiiana, anything that had to do with the Hawaiian people, stories. And they piled it in the middle of the school grounds and had a big bonfire. So that's her word, bonfire.
And they just burned all the books?
Yes. So I guess from then on, you never really had anything on Hawaiiana in school there.
And who led the bonfire?
I guess the principal. He was pure Hawaiian. He was pure Hawaiian. And he burnt all the books there. And I did hear at the church in Kealia, the Hawaiian church, and he supposedly burnt all the books, all the records that they had there too. And he said, now we're all American.
Oh. Wow, when I hear about that, Mama, I think how sad that must have been for everybody. How strange. And to make the children carry the books out into the yard like that, that's kind of pathological, I think, but real colonized thinking, yeah?
I guess so.
Well, that's a sad story, Mama, but I really appreciate you sharing it because I think it's the kind of story that plenty of us need to hear, you know, so that we really understand these little small pieces of our own history, you know, even though it's unpleasant and it's painful. I think that's the beginning of being able to be healed, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there's mm-hmm. been a language revitalization for the past few decades, so thank God that despite acts like that, the language has survived. And it makes me sad to think of all the stories that were lost in that bonfire.
I know. I think about it too.
In this week's Ho'aelona report, Lamaku Mikahalo Roy explains why some birds represent the link between humans and the divine.
Launa ka iyo iluna, kawana e ka ihi ilalo. The iyo dwells with us above, the sacredness alights upon us below. The mist covering the lands, especially the sacred mountain, Mauna Wakea, expresses that which is covered is too sacred for the countenance and eyes of man. The absence of the flight of the heavenly hawk is likewise the sign that work for the highest light proceeds all but unseen by the great orchestrator of life, Akua Mana Mana Loa. When sacred Io appears in the sky, here is the Ho'aelona Supreme that confirms divine creator's victory, Kalanakila, over all manifestations of lesser light upon Hawaii, Kalua Kalani, and all the earth. In 2010, spiritual messages from the great Pacific ancestors of the light began to come forth at Kamakuhonu. What was 2010 but the 200th anniversary of the unification of the Hawaiian Islands by Kamehameha the Great? It were these Pacific ancestors of light whom Kamehameha II, King Liholiho, praised and acknowledged in his famous words that became the proverb, Nawai ho ika ole o kia kamai, he ala hele I ma'a ika hele ia e o umau makua. Who would not be wise upon a path so well traveled by my ancestors? This was his response to the praise of his wisdom. These are the great Pacific ancestors of the light that I here and now praise and acknowledge as the source for every Ho'aelona report I share. They guide us in upholding the highest light of Akua at Kamakuhonu, capital of the abiding kingdom of Hawaii, unified by Kamehameha the Great. Oivi Kahiapo, the firstborn of Akua, remind us all of earth created by Akua belongs to Akua. For the native truth, I'm Lamaku Mikahala Roy, Kahu of Ahuenaheiau, Kamakuhonu, Hawaii.
We end this week's show with a recording of Blue Hawaii from the 1920s. It's a novelty record. Those were used by radio stations who needed to fill the air but couldn't pay the royalty fees. This one is by Les Royal Hawaiians. I came across a note in a thread that said it's a recording by Francis Lei Wong, who left Hawaii to study medicine at Indiana University and recorded a bunch of songs while he was there. I suspect he was probably homesick. I mean, good gods of Oceania, going from Hawaii to the middle of America like that, I don't know. We're all ocean people here. Anyways, shortly after he graduated and moved home, he passed away from tuberculosis. I love knowing who the voice is behind this song, though it's sad he died so soon after coming home. Maybe playing his song now can be another way of him coming home to us 90 years later. Our kupuna still sing to us. How lovely is that? Please remember to support The Native Truth with a donation at thenativetruth.com or annkaylakelly.com. It takes time, energy, and resources to produce Ku'e Native media that isn't part of the nonprofit industrial complex or the state. If you want to hear more podcasts like this one, support the making of it. As always, mahalo nui to Teokasin Ghost Horse for his beautiful song, Prayer, from the album Ksa, and to Lamaku Mikahala Roy for the Ho'aelona Report. And big mahalo to Lani Sinkin for all he does on behalf of Kanaka Uiwi, the Aina, and our Moana. He's definitely koa for and with us, guys. And lastly, I want to mahalo my own Makuahine for her bittersweet story about learning how Hawaiians used to communicate from one end of the island to the other. We all need to hear our kupuna when they talk story with us, even if those stories are often sad. It's part of our recovery as a people. For the Native Truth, I'm Ann Kayla Kelly. A hui ho malama pono. Until the last aloha aina.
Like a Honolulu honeymoon. Oh, my hearty.